Don't speak, please, don't speak.
But who told you so?
Nobody says so. I'm sure he was in love with you, and is still in love, but...
Oh, dear, these commiserations are what I dread most of all, cried Kitty, suddenly flaring up. She turned on her chair, blushed, and began rapidly moving her fingers, pressing now with one hand and now with the other the buckle of a belt she was holding. Dolly knew her sister's habit of fingering something when she was heated, and she knew how apt Kitty was to forget herself when in a passion, and to say much that was unpleasant and had better not have been said. She tried to pacify her, but it was too late.
"What do you want me to feel? What?" said Kitty, quickly. "That I was in love with a man who wouldn't have anything to do with me, and that I am dying for love of him, and it is my sister who says that to me? My sister who imagines that she sympathises with me? I don't want this commiseration and hypocrisy."
"Kitty, you are unfair.
Why do you torment me?"
"On the contrary, I see you are in distress." But Kitty, in her excitement, did not listen to her.
"There is nothing for me to grieve for or seek comfort about. I have enough pride never to let myself love a man who does not love me."
"But I'm not suggesting it. Only tell me frankly," said Dolly, taking her by the hand. "Did Lievin speak to you?" The mention of Lievin seemed to deprive Kitty of the last fragments of self-control. She jumped up from her chair, threw the buckle on the floor, and rapidly gesticulating with her hands, she began,
"What has Lievin to do with it? I don't understand why you need torment me. I have said, and I repeat, I will never, never do what you are doing, returning to a man who has betrayed you and who has loved another woman. I can't understand it. You may do it, but I can't."
Having said these words, she looked at her sister, and seeing that Dolly remained silent, with her head bowed sadly, Kitty, instead of leaving the room as she had intended to do, sat down by the door, and, hiding her face in her handkerchief, let her head sink down. For a minute or two there was silence. Dolly was thinking about herself. The humiliation of which she was always conscious was peculiarly painful when her sister touched on it. She had not expected such cruelty from her, and was angry with her. But suddenly she heard the rustle of a dress, and a burst of suppressed sobbing. A pair of arms encircled her neck from below, and Kitty was kneeling before her.
"Dolly, dear, I am so, so unhappy,"
she whispered guiltily. And the sweet, tear-stained face hid itself in the folds of Dolly's dress. As if tears were the necessary lubricant without which the machine of mutual confidence could not work properly between the sisters, after having had a cry they started talking of indifferent matters and in so doing understood one another. Kitty knew that what she had said in her anger about the unfaithfulness of Dolly's husband and about her humiliation had cut her poor sister to the depths of her heart, but that she was forgiven. While Dolly, on her side, learnt all that she wanted to know, her suspicions were confirmed, and she understood that Kitty's grief, her hopeless grief, was really caused by the fact that Lievin had proposed to her, and that she had rejected him. And now that Vronsky had deceived her, she was prepared to love Lievin and to hate Vronsky. Kitty did not say a word of this. She spoke only of her state of mind.
"I have no troubles, whatever," she said when she had grown calm. "But can you understand that everything has become horrid, disgusting, and coarse to me, and above all, I myself? You can't think what horrid thoughts I have about everything."
"And what horrid thoughts can you have?" asked Dolly, smiling. "The very nastiest and coarsest, I can't tell you. It is not grief, not dullness, but much worse. It is as if all that was good in me had hidden itself, and only what is horrid remains. How am I to tell you?" she continued, noticing perplexity in her sister's eyes. "Papa began to speak to me just now. It seems to me that he thinks that all I need is to get married. Mama takes me to a ball, and it seems to me she only takes me there to marry me off as quickly as possible and get rid of me. I know it is not true, but I can't get rid of the idea.
I can't bear to see the so-called eligible men. I always think they're taking my measure. Formerly, to go anywhere in a ball dress was just a pleasure to me. I used to like myself in it. But now I feel ashamed and uncomfortable. Well, what is one to do? The doctor... Kitty became confused. She was going to say that since this change had come over her, Oblonsky had become intolerably disagreeable to her, and that she could not see him without having the coarsest and most monstrous fancies. Well, you see, everything appears to me in the coarsest and most horrid aspect, she continued. That is my illness. Perhaps it will pass. But don't think I can't. I only feel comfortable with children, only in your house. What a pity you can't come to see us. But I will come. I have had scarlet fever, and I will persuade Mama to let me. And Kitty insisted on having her own way, went to her sister's, and nursed the children all through the scarlet fever that really attacked them. The two sisters nursed all the six children successfully through the illness, but Kitty's health did not improve, and in Lent the Shcherbatskys went abroad. Chapter 4. The highest Petersburg society is really all one. All who belong to it know and even visit one another. But this large circle has its subdivisions. Anna Arkadyevna Karenina had friends and close connections in three different sets. One of these was her husband's official set, consisting of his colleagues and subordinates, who in most varied and capricious ways were connected and separated by social conditions. Anna found it hard now to recall the feeling of almost religious respect she had at first felt for these people. Now she knew them all as well as the inhabitants of a provincial town know one another. She knew the habits and weaknesses of each of them, and where the shoe pinched this or that foot. She knew their relations to one another and to the governing centre. She knew who sided with whom, and how and by what means each supported himself, and who agreed or disagreed with whom and about what. But, in spite of admonitions and advice from the Countess Lydia Ivanovna, this bureaucratic circle of male interests could not interest Anna, and she avoided it. Another circle with which Anna was intimate was that through which Karenin had made his career. The centre of that circle was the Countess Lydia Ivanovna. It consisted of elderly, plain, philanthropic, and pious women, and clever, well-educated, ambitious men. One of the clever men who belonged to it called it the conscience of Petersburg society. Karenin set great value on this circle, and Anna, who knew how to get on with everyone, had, during the first part of her life in Petersburg, made friends in it too. But now, on her return from Moscow, that circle became unbearable to her. It seemed to her that she and all of them were only pretending, and she felt so bored and uncomfortable in that society that she visited Lydia Ivanovna as rarely as possible. The third circle with which Anna was connected was society in the accepted meaning of the word. The society of balls, dinner parties, brilliant toilette. The society which clung to the court with one hand lest it should sink to the demi-monde. For this the members of that society thought they despised, though its tastes were not only similar but identical with their own. Anna was connected with this set through the Princess Betsy Tverskaya, the wife of her cousin, who had an income of 120,000 rubles a year, and who, from the time Anna first appeared in society, had particularly liked her, made much of her, and drawn her into her own set, making fun of that to which the Countess Lydia Ivanovna belonged. "When I am old and ugly, I will become like that," Betsy used to say. "But for you, a young and beautiful woman, it is too early to settle down in that almshouse." At first, Anna had avoided the Princess Tverskaya's set as much as she could, because it demanded more expense than she could afford, and also because she really approved more of the other set. But after her visit to Moscow, all this was reversed. She avoided her moral friends and went into grand society.
There she saw Vronsky and experienced a tremulous joy when meeting him. She met him most frequently at Betsy's, who was a Vronsky herself and his cousin. Vronsky went everywhere where he had a chance of meeting Anna, and spoke to her of his love whenever he could. She gave him no encouragement, but every time they met there sprang up that feeling of animation which had seized her in the train on the morning when she first saw him. She was aware that when they met, joy lit up her eyes and drew her lips into a smile, but she could not hide the expression of that joy. At first, Anna sincerely believed that she was displeased with him for allowing himself to persecute her. But soon after her return from Moscow, having gone to a party where she expected to meet him but to which she did not come, she clearly realized, by the sadness that overcame her, that she had been deceiving herself, and that his persecution supplied the whole interest of her life. A famous prima donna was giving her second performance, and all high society was at the opera house. Vronsky, from the front row of the stalls, seeing his cousin, went to her box without waiting for the interval. "Why did you not come to dinner?" she said, adding with a smile and so that only he could hear her, "I am amazed at the clairvoyance of lovers. She was not there. But come in after the opera." Vronsky looked at her inquiringly. She nodded, and he thanked her by a smile and sat down beside her. "And how well I remember your ridicule," continued the Princess Betsy, who took particular pleasure in following the progress of this passion. "What has become of it all? You are caught, my dear fellow."
"I wish for nothing better than to be caught," replied Vronsky, with his calm, good-natured smile. "To tell the truth, if I complain at all, it is only of not being caught enough. I am beginning to lose hope."
"What hope can you have?" said Betsy, offended on her friend's behalf.
"Entendons-nous."
But in her eyes little sparks twinkled which said that she understood very well, and just as he did, what hope he might have.
"None whatever," said Vronsky, laughing and showing his close-set teeth. "Excuse me," he added, taking from her hand the opera glasses, and he set to work to scan across her bare shoulder the row of boxes opposite. "I am afraid I am becoming ridiculous." He knew very well that he ran no risk of appearing ridiculous either in Betsy's eyes or in the eyes of society people generally. He knew very well that in their eyes the role of the disappointed lover of a maiden, or of any single woman, might be ridiculous, but the role of a man who was pursuing a married woman, and who made it the purpose of his life at all cost to draw her into adultery, was one which had in it something beautiful and dignified, and could never be ridiculous. So it was with a proud, glad smile lurking under his moustache that he put down the opera glasses and looked at his cousin.
"And why did you not come to dinner?" she said admiringly.
"I must tell you about that. I was engaged, and with what do you think? I'll give you 100 or 1,000 guesses, and you won't find out. I was making peace between a husband and a fellow who'd insulted his wife. Yes, really."
"Well, and did you succeed?"
"Nearly."
"You must tell me all about it," she said, rising. "Come back in the next interval."
"I can't. I'm going to the French Theatre."
"What? From Nielsen?" asked Betsy, quite horrified,
though she could not have distinguished Nielsen's voice from that of a chorus girl. "It can't be helped. I have an appointment there in connection with this same peacemaking of mine."
"Blessed are the peacemakers, for they will be saved," said Betsy, remembering that she had heard someone say something like that. "Well, then, sit down and tell me about it." And she sat down again.
Chapter 5
"It's rather improper, but so charming that I long to tell it," said Vronsky, gazing at her with laughing eyes. "I shan't mention names."
"So much the better. I shall guess them."
"Well, then, listen. Two gay young fellows were out driving.
Officers of your regiment, of course?"
"I didn't say officers, but just two young men who had been lunching."
"Translate that not wisely, but too well."
"It may be. They were on their way to dine with a comrade and in the highest spirits. They see that a pretty woman in a hired sledge is passing them, looking at them, and laughing and nodding to them. At any rate, they think so. Of course, off they go after her, galloping full speed. To their surprise, the lovely one stops at the door of the very house they are going to. She runs up to the top flat. They only manage to see a pair of red lips beneath a short veil and lovely little feet. You tell it with so much feeling that I think you yourself must have been one of the two. And what did you say to me just now? Well, the young men go into their comrade's flat. He was giving a farewell dinner. There they may really have drunk rather too much, as always happens at farewell dinners. At dinner they inquire who lives in the top flat. No one knows. But their host's footman, in answer to their question whether girls live there, replies that there are a lot of them thereabouts. After dinner, the young men go into the host's study to compose a letter to the fair stranger, and, having written one full of passion and containing a declaration, they carry it upstairs themselves, in order to explain anything that might not be quite clear in the letter. "Why do you tell me such horrors?" "Well?" They ring. A maid opens the door. They give her the letter and assure her that they are both so much in love that they will die at once on the doorstep. The maid, quite bewildered, carries on the negotiations. Suddenly, a gentleman with sausage-shaped whiskers and as red as a lobster appears, announces that no one but his wife lives in that flat, and turns them both out.
How do you know he had sausage-shaped whiskers, as you say?
You just listen. Today, I went to reconcile them.
Well, what happened?
This is the most interesting part. It turns out that the happy couple are a titular counsellor and a titular counselloress. The titular counsellor lodges a complaint, and I turn into a peacemaker. And what a peacemaker! I assure you, Talleyrand was nothing to me.
What was the difficulty?
You shall hear. We duly apologised. We are in despair. We beg to be forgiven for our unfortunate mistake. The titular counsellor, with his sausages, begins to thaw, but also wishes to express his feelings, and as soon as he begins to express them, he begins to get excited and grows insulting, and again I have to set all my diplomatic talents in motion. I agree that they acted badly, but beg you to consider that it was a mistake. Consider their youth. Besides which, the young men had just dined, you understand? They repent from the bottom of their hearts and ask you to forgive their fault. The titular counsellor again softens. I am willing to forgive them, Count, but you must understand that my wife, a respectable woman, has been subjected to the rudeness and insults of these hobbledehoys, these scoundrels, and you must remember that one of the hobbledehoys is standing there, and I have to reconcile them. Again I set my diplomacy going, and again, just as the whole business should be concluded, my titular counsellor flies into a rage, gets red, his sausages stick out, and again I dissolve into diplomatic subtlety. Oh, you must hear this, cried Betsy, laughing and turning to a lady who was just entering the box. He has made me laugh so. Well, bonne chance, she added, giving Vronsky a finger that was not engaged in holding her fan, and with a movement of her shoulders making the bodice of her dress that had risen a little slip down again, that she might be befittingly nude on returning to the front of the box into the glare of gaslight and the gaze of all eyes. Vronsky went to the French theatre, where he really had to see the commander of his regiment, who never omitted a single performance there, to talk over this reconciliation business which had occupied and amused him for the last 3 days. Petritsky, whom Vronsky was fond of, was mixed up in the affair, and so was young Prince Kedrov, a first-rate fellow and a capital comrade who had lately joined the regiment. Above all, the interests of the regiment were involved. Both officers belonged to Vronsky's squadron. Titular Councillor Wendon had been to see the commander and had lodged a complaint against the officers who had insulted his wife. His young wife, so Wendon declared, he'd been married 6 months, had been to church with her mother, and suddenly feeling unwell as a result of her interesting condition, was unable to stand any longer and took the first good sledge she could find. These officers, in their sledge, raced after her.
She became frightened and, feeling still more unwell, ran up the stairs to her flat. Wendon himself, having returned from his office and hearing the front doorbell and voices, went out, saw the tipsy officers with the letter, and hustled them out. He requested that they should be severely punished.
"No, say what you like,"
the commander remarked to Vronsky, whom he had invited to his house. "Petritsky is becoming impossible. Not a week passes without some scandal. That councillor will not let the matter rest. He will go further with it." Vronsky realized how ungrateful a task it was, that a duel was out of the question, and that everything must be done to soften the titular councillor and hush up the affair. The CO had called Vronsky in just because he knew him to be honourable and able, and above all a man who valued the honour of the regiment. After discussing the matter, they decided that Vronsky should go with Petritsky and Kedrov to apologize to the councillor. Both the commander and Vronsky were aware that Vronsky's name and his badge as aide-de-camp to the emperor ought greatly to help in softening the titular councillor's feelings, and really these things had a partial effect. But the result of the peacemaking still remained doubtful, as Vronsky had explained. Having reached the French theatre, Vronsky went out into the foyer with the CO and informed him of his success or lack of success. After considering the whole question, the commander decided to let the matter drop. But for amusement, he asked Vronsky for particulars of the interview, and could not help laughing for a long time as he listened to the description of how the titular councillor suddenly again flared up at the recollection of some incident of the affair, and how Vronsky manoeuvred so as to retire just at the last half-word of reconciliation, pushing Petritsky before him.
"A bad business, but most amusing. Oh, Kedrov cannot fight that good man." "And so he was in a great rage?" repeated the commander, laughing. "But what do you think of Claire this evening?" "Wonderful," he went on, referring to the new French actress. "However often one sees her, she is new each day. Only the French can do that."
Chapter 6 Princess Betsy went home without waiting for the end of the last act. She had scarcely time to go to her dressing room, put powder on her long, pale face and rub it off again, smarten herself up and order tea to be served in the big drawing room, before one carriage after another began to arrive at the door of her immense house on the Great Morskaya. The visitors passed beneath the broad portico, and the massive hall porter, who in the mornings read a newspaper behind the glass panes of the front door for the edification of passers-by, now noiselessly opened this enormous door to admit them. Almost at one and the same time, the hostess, her hair rearranged and her face freshened up, entered at one door and the visitors at another of the large, dark-walled drawing-room, with its thick carpets and brightly lit table, shining in the candlelight with white tablecloth, silver samovar, and translucent china. The hostess sat down beside the samovar and took off her gloves. The chairs being moved by the aid of unobtrusive footmen, the company settled down, separating into two circles, one with the hostess round the samovar, the other at the opposite end of the room round the wife of an ambassador, a beautiful woman with black, sharply outlined eyebrows in a black velvet dress. The conversation in both circles, as always happens at first, hesitated for a few minutes, was interrupted by greetings, recognitions, and offers of tea, and seemed to be seeking something to settle on.
"She is wonderfully good as an actress. One sees that she has studied Kaulbach," remarked an attaché in the circle round the ambassador's wife. "Did you notice how she fell?"
"Oh, please don't let us talk about Nielsen. It's impossible to say anything new about her," said a stout, red-faced, fair-haired lady who wore an old silk dress and had no eyebrows and no chignon. This was the Princess Myakaya, notorious for her simplicity and the roughness of her manners and nicknamed L'Enfant Terrible. The Princess Myakaya was seated midway between the two circles, listening and taking part in the conversation of both.
"This very same sentence about Kaulbach has been repeated to me by three different people today, as if by arrangement. That sentence, I don't know why, seemed to please them very much,"
The conversation was broken by this remark, and it became necessary to find another topic.
"Tell us something amusing, but not malicious," said the ambassador's wife, a great adept at that kind of elegant conversation which the English call small talk, turning to the attaché, who was also at a loss what subject to start.
"People say that is very difficult, and that only what is malicious is amusing," he began with a smile. "But I will try, if you will give me a theme. The theme is everything. Once one has a theme, it is easy to embroider on it. I often think that the famous talkers of the last century would find it difficult to talk cleverly nowadays. We are all so tired of the clever things."
"That was said long ago," interrupted the ambassador's wife, laughingly.
The conversation had begun very prettily, but just because it was too pretty, it languished again. They had to return to the one sure and never-failing resource, slander.
"Don't you think there is something Louis Cannes about Tushkevich?" said the attaché, glancing at a handsome, fair-haired young man who stood by the tea-table.
"Oh, yes, he matches the drawing-room. That is why he comes here so often."
This conversation did not flag, since it hinted at what could not be spoken of in this room, namely at the relations existing between Tushkevich and their hostess. Around the hostess and the samovar, the conversation, after flickering for some time in the same way between the three inevitable themes, the latest public news, the theatre, and criticism of one's neighbour, also caught on when it got to the last of these themes, slander.
"Have you heard that that Maltaisheva woman also, not the daughter, but the mother, is having a Diable Rose costume made for herself?"
"You don't mean to say so. How delicious!"
"I wonder that she, with her common sense, for she's not stupid, does not see how ridiculous she makes herself." Everyone had something disparaging to say about the unfortunate Maltaisheva, and the conversation began crackling merrily like a kindling bonfire. The Princess Betsy's husband, a fat, good-natured man, an enthusiastic collector of engravings, hearing that his wife had visitors, entered the drawing-room before going to his club. Stepping silently on the thick carpet, he approached the Princess Mayakaya.
"How did you like Nielsen?"
he inquired.
"Oh, how can you steal on one like that? How you frightened me," said she in reply. "Please don't talk to me about the opera. You know nothing of music. I'd better descend to your level and talk about your majolica and engravings. Come now, tell me about the treasures you've picked up lately at the rag fair."
"Shall I show you? But you don't understand them."
"Yes, let me see them. I have learned from those, what is their name? The bankers, they have some splendid engravings. They showed them to us."
"What? Have you been to the Schutzburgs?"
asked the hostess from her place by the samovar.
"I have, ma chère. They asked my husband and me to dinner, and I was told that the sauce alone at that dinner cost 1,000 rubles, said the Princess Mayakaya loudly, feeling that everybody was listening.
"And a very nasty sauce it was, too, something green. We had to invite them, and I gave them a sauce that cost 85 kopecks and satisfied everyone. I can't afford 1,000-ruble sauces."
"She is unique," said the hostess.
"Wonderful," said someone else.
The effect produced by the Princess Mayakaya's words was always the same, and the secret of that effect lay in the fact that although she often, as at that moment, spoke not quite to the point, her words were simple and had a meaning. In the society in which she lived, words of that kind produced the effect of a most witty joke. The Princess Mayakaya did not understand why her words had such an effect, but was aware that they did and availed herself of it. As while she was speaking, everybody listened to her and the conversation in the circle around the ambassador's wife stopped, the hostess wished to make one circle of the whole company, and turning to the ambassador's wife, said,
"Will you really not have a cup of tea? You should come and join us here."
"No, we are very comfortable here," replied
the ambassador's wife, smiling, and she continued the interrupted conversation. It was a very pleasant conversation. They were disparaging the Karenins, husband and wife.
Anna has changed very much since her trip to Moscow. There is something strange about her, said a friend of Anna's. The chief change is that she has brought back with her the shadow of Alexei Vronsky, said the ambassador's wife. Well, why not? Grimm has a fable called The Man Without a Shadow, about a man who lost his shadow as a punishment for something or other. I never could understand why it was a punishment. But for a woman to be without a shadow can't be pleasant. Yes, but a woman with a shadow generally ends badly, said Anna's friend.
A murrain on your tongue, suddenly remarked the Princess Myakaya, hearing these words. Anna Karenina is a splendid woman. I don't like her husband, but I'm very fond of her.
Why don't you like her husband? He's such a remarkable man, said the ambassador's wife.
My husband says there are few statesmen like him in Europe. My husband tells me the same, but I don't believe it, replied the Princess Myakaya.
If our husbands didn't talk, we should see things as they really are, and it's my opinion that Karenin is simply stupid. I say it in a whisper.
Does this not make everything quite clear?
Formerly, when I was told to consider him wise, I kept trying to, and thought I was stupid myself, because I was unable to perceive his wisdom. But as soon as I said to myself, he's stupid only in a whisper, of course, it all became quite clear, don't you think so?
How malicious you are today.
Not at all. I have no choice.
One of us is stupid, and you know it's impossible to say so of oneself.
No one is satisfied with his position, but everyone is satisfied with his wit, remarked the attaché, quoting some French lines.
That's it. That's just it, rejoined the Princess Myakaya, turning quickly toward him. But the point is that I won't abandon Anna to you. She is so excellent, so charming. What is she to do if everyone is in love with her and follows her about like a shadow?
But I don't even think of blaming her, Anna's friend said, justifying herself.
If no one follows us about like a shadow, that does not prove that we have a right to judge her.
Having snubbed Anna's friend handsomely, the Princess Myakaya rose with the ambassador's wife and joined those at the table, where there was a general conversation about the King of Prussia.
Whom are you backbiting there? Asked Betsy.
The Karenins.
The princess was characterizing Karenin, replied the ambassador's wife with a smile, seating herself at the table.
It's a pity we did not hear it, said the hostess, glancing at the door.
Ah, here you are at last, she added, smilingly addressing Vronsky as he entered the room.
Vronsky not only knew everybody in the room, but saw them all every day, so he entered in the calm manner of one who rejoins those from whom he has parted only a short time before.
"Where do I come from?" he said in reply to the ambassador's wife. "There's no help for it. I must confess that I come from the Théâtre Bouffe. I have been there 100 times, and always with fresh pleasure. Excellent. I know it's a disgrace, but at the opera I go to sleep, while at the Bouffe I stay till the last minute enjoying it. Tonight—"
he named a French actress, and was about to tell them something about her, when the ambassador's wife stopped him with mock alarm.
"Please don't talk about those horrors."
"All right, I won't, especially as everybody knows those horrors."
"And everybody would go there if it were considered the thing, as the opera is,"
put in the Princess Myakaya. Chapter 7 Steps were heard at the entrance, and the Princess Betsy, knowing that it was Anna, glanced at Vronsky. He was looking at the door with a strange new expression on his face. He gazed joyfully, intently, and yet timidly at the lady who was entering, and slowly rose from his seat. Anna entered the room, holding herself, as usual, very erect, and without changing the direction of her eyes, approached her hostess, walking with that quick, firm yet light step which distinguished her from other society women. She shook hands smilingly, and with the same smile looked round at Vronsky. He bowed low and moved a chair toward her. Anna responded only by an inclination of the head, though she blushed and frowned. But immediately, nodding rapidly to her acquaintances and pressing the hands extended to her, she turned again to her hostess.
I have just been at the Countess Lydia's. I meant to come sooner, but could not get away. Sir John was there. He is very interesting. Oh, that missionary? Yes, he was telling us about Indian life. It was very interesting. The conversation, interrupted by her entrance, again burnt up like the flame of a lamp that has been blown out. Sir John? Oh, yes, Sir John. I have seen him. He speaks very well. The elder Vlasyeva is quite in love with him.
And is it true that the younger Vlasyeva is going to be married to Topov?
Yes, they say it's quite settled.
I'm surprised at her parents. They say it's a love match. Love match? What antediluvian ideas you have. Who talks of love nowadays? Said the ambassador's wife.
What's to be done? That silly old fashion hasn't died out yet, said Vronsky.
So much the worse for those who follow the fashion. I know of happy marriages, but only such as are founded on reason.
Yes, but how often the happiness of marriages founded on reason crumbles to dust because the very passion that was disregarded makes itself felt later, said Vronsky.
But by marriages founded on reason, we mean marriages between those who have both passed through that madness. It's like scarlet fever. One has to get it over.
Then someone should invent a way of inoculating love, like vaccination.
When I was young, I was in love with a chorister, said Princess Mayakaya.
I don't know whether it did me any good.
No, joking apart, I believe that to understand love, one must first make a mistake and then correct it, said the Princess Betsy.
Even after marriage, said the ambassador's wife, archly.
It is never too late to mend, said the attaché, quoting the English proverb.
Exactly, chimed in Betsy. One has to make mistakes and correct them.
What do you think? She asked, addressing Anna, who, with a scarcely discernible, resolute smile, was listening to this conversation.
I think, replied Anna, toying with the glove she had pulled off,
I think if it is true that there are as many minds as there are heads, then there are as many kinds of love as there are hearts.
Vronsky had gazed at Anna, and with sinking heart waited to hear what she would say. He sighed, as after a danger averted when she had uttered these words. Suddenly Anna addressed him.
I have received a letter from Moscow. They write that Kitty Shcherbatskaya is very ill.
Really? Said Vronsky, frowning.
Anna glanced sternly at him.
It does not interest you?
On the contrary, it interests me very much. What exactly do they write, if I may ask? He inquired.
Anna rose and went up to Betsy. Give me a cup of tea, she said, stopping behind Betsy's chair.
While Betsy was pouring out the tea, Vronsky went up to Anna.
What do they write? He asked again.
I often think men don't understand honour, though they're always talking about it, said Anna, without answering his question. I have long wanted to tell you, she added, and moving a few steps to a side table on which lay some albums, she sat down.
I don't quite understand your meaning, he said, handing her the cup.
I wanted to tell you, she began again, without looking at him, that you have behaved badly, very badly.
Don't I know that I behaved badly?
But who was the cause?
Why say that to me? She asked, looking severely at him.
You know why, he answered, boldly and joyously, meeting her look and continuing to gaze at her. It was not he, but she, who became abashed.
That only proves you have no heart, she said.
But her look said that she knew he had a heart and that she therefore feared him.
What you have just referred to was a mistake, and not love.
Anna shuddered and said, Don't you remember that I forbade you to mention that word,
that
horrid word. But then she felt that the one word for bad showed that she claimed certain rights over him, thereby encouraging him to speak of love. "I have long wanted to say that to you," she went on, looking resolutely into his eyes, her face all aglow and suffused with a burning blush. "And today I came on purpose, knowing I should meet you here. I have come to tell you that this must stop. I have never till now had to blush before anyone, but you make me feel as if I were guilty of something."
He looked at her and was struck by the new spiritual beauty of her face.
"What do you want of me?" he asked, simply and seriously.
"I want you to go to Moscow and beg Kitty's pardon," said she.
"You don't want that," he replied.
He saw that she was saying what she forced herself to utter and not what she wished to say.
"If you love me as you say you do,"
she whispered,
"behave so that I may be at peace."
His face brightened.
"Don't you know that you are all my life to me? But peace, I do not know and can't give to you. My whole being, my love, yes, I cannot think about you and about myself separately. You and I are one to me. And I do not see before us the possibility of peace either for me or for you. I see the possibility of despair, misfortune, or of happiness. What happiness? Is it impossible?"
he added with his lips only, but she heard. She exerted all the powers of her mind to say what she ought, but instead she fixed on him her eyes filled with love and did not answer at all.
"This is it," he thought with rapture. "Just as I was beginning to despair, and when it seemed as though the end would never come, here it is. She loves me. She acknowledges it.
Do this for me. Never say such words to me, and let us be good friends." These were her words, but her eyes said something very different.
"Friends we shall not be, you know that yourself, but whether we shall be the happiest or the most miserable of human beings rests with you."
She wished to say something, but he interrupted her. "I ask only one thing. I ask the right to hope and suffer as I do now. But if even that is impossible, command me to disappear, and I will do it. You shall not see me if my presence is painful to you.
I don't want to drive you away. Only don't change anything. Leave everything as it is," he said with trembling voice. "Here's your husband."
Indeed, just at that moment, Karenin, with his deliberate, ungraceful gait, entered the drawing-room. He glanced at his wife and Vronsky, went up to the hostess, and having sat down with a cup of tea, began talking in his deliberate and always clear tones, in his usual ironical way, ridiculing somebody.
"Your Hotel Rambouillet is in full muster," said he, glancing round the whole company. "The Graces and the Muses."
But the Princess Betsy could not bear that tone of his, sneering, she called it, in English. So, like a clever hostess, she at once led him into a serious conversation on universal military service. Karenin was immediately absorbed in the conversation and began defending the new law very earnestly against the Princess Betsy, who attacked it. Vronsky and Anna remained sitting at the little table.
"This is becoming indecent," whispered a lady, indicating by a glance Vronsky, Anna, and Anna's husband.
"What did I tell you?" replied Anna's friend.
Not these two ladies alone, but nearly all those present in the drawing-room, even the Princess Myakaya and Betsy herself, several times glanced across at the pair who had gone away from the general circle, as if their having done so disturbed the others.
Only Karenin did not once glance that way and was not distracted from the interesting conversation in which he was engaged. Noticing the unpleasant impression produced on everyone, the Princess Betsy manoeuvred for someone else to take her place and to listen to Karenin, and she herself went up to Anna.
"I am always amazed at your husband's clearness and exactitude of expression," she said. "The most transcendental ideas become accessible to me when he speaks."
"Oh, yes," said Anna, radiant with a smile of happiness and not understanding a single word of what Betsy was saying, and going across to the big table, she joined in the general conversation. After half an hour's stay, Karenin went up to his wife and suggested that they should go home together, but, without looking at him, she answered that she would stay to supper. Karenin bowed to the company and went away. The Karenin's fat old Tatar coachman in his shiny leather coat was finding it hard to control the near grey horse that had grown restive with cold waiting before the portico. The footman stood holding open the carriage door. The hall porter stood with his hand on the outer front door. Anna, with her deft little hand, was disengaging the lace of her sleeve which had caught on a hook of her fur coat, and with bent head was listening with delight to what Vronsky, who accompanied her, was saying.
"Granted that you have not said anything, I don't demand anything," he was saying. "But you know that it is not friendship I want. Only one happiness is possible for me in life, the word you so dislike. Yes, love."
"Love," she slowly repeated to herself, and suddenly, while releasing the lace, she added aloud, "The reason I dislike that word is that it means too much for me, far more than you can understand." And she looked him in the face. "Au revoir." She gave him her hand, and with her quick, elastic step, went past the hall porter and vanished into the carriage. Her glance and the touch of her hand burnt him. He kissed the palm of his hand where she had touched it, and went home happy in the knowledge that in this one evening he had made more progress toward his aim than he had during the previous 2 months. Chapter 8. Karenin did not see anything peculiar or improper in his wife's conversing animatedly with Vronsky at a separate table, but he noticed that others in the drawing-room considered it peculiar and improper. Therefore he also considered it improper and decided to speak to his wife about it. When he reached home, he went to his study as usual, seated himself in his easy chair, and opened a book on the papacy at the place where his paper knife was inserted. He read till 1 o'clock, as was his wont, only now and then rubbing his high forehead and jerking his head as if driving something away. At the usual hour he rose and prepared for bed. Anna had not yet returned. With the book under his arm he went upstairs, but tonight, instead of his usual thoughts and calculations about his official affairs, his mind was full of his wife and of something unpleasant that had happened concerning her. Contrary to his habit, he did not go to bed, but with his hands clasped behind his back started pacing up and down the rooms. He felt that he could not lie down till he had thought over these newly arisen circumstances. When Karenin had decided to talk the matter over with his wife, it had seemed to him quite easy and simple to do so. But now, when he began considering how to approach her, the matter appeared very difficult and complicated. He was not of a jealous disposition. Jealousy, in his opinion, insulted a wife, and a man should have confidence in his wife. Why he should have confidence, that is, a full conviction that his young wife would always love him, he never asked himself. But he felt no distrust, and therefore had confidence, and assured himself that it was right to have it. Now, though his conviction that jealousy is a shameful feeling, and that one ought to have confidence, had not been destroyed, he felt that he was face to face with something illogical and stupid, and he did not know what to do.
Karenin was being confronted with life, with the possibility of his wife's loving somebody else, and this seemed stupid and incomprehensible to him, because it was life itself. He had lived and worked all his days in official spheres, which deal with reflections of life, and every time he had knocked up against life itself, he had stepped out of its way. He now experienced a sensation such as a man might feel who, while quietly crossing a bridge over an abyss, suddenly sees that the bridge is being taken to pieces and that he is facing the abyss. The abyss was real life. The bridge was the artificial life Karenin had been living. It was the first time that the possibility of his wife's falling in love with anybody had occurred to him, and he was horrified. He did not undress, but paced up and down with his even step on the resounding parquet floor of the dining room, which was lit by one lamp, over the carpet of the dark drawing room where a light was reflected only from a recently painted portrait of himself which hung above the sofa, and on through her sitting room, where two candles were burning, lighting up the portraits of her relatives and friends, and the elegant knick-knacks, long familiar to him, on her writing-table. Through her room he reached the door of their bedroom, and then turned back again. From time to time he stopped, generally on the parquet floor of the lamp-lit dining-room, and thought, "Yes, it is necessary to decide and to stop it, to express my opinion of it and my decision." Then he turned back again. "But express what? What decision?" he asked himself in the drawing-room, and could find no answer. "But after all," he reflected before turning into her room, "what is it that has happened? Nothing at all. She had a long talk with him. Well, what of that? Are there not plenty of men with whom a woman may talk? Besides, to be jealous is to degrade myself and her," he said to himself as he entered her sitting-room. But that consideration which formerly had weighed so much with him now had neither weight nor meaning. At the bedroom door he turned back, and as soon as he re-entered the dark drawing-room a voice seemed to whisper that it was not so, and that if others noticed, that showed that there must have been something for them to notice. And again he repeated to himself in the dining-room, "Yes, it is necessary to decide and stop it and express my opinion." And again in the drawing-room at the turn into her room he asked himself, "Decide what?" And then, "What has happened?" And he replied, "Nothing," and remembered that jealousy is a feeling which insults a wife. But in the drawing-room he came again to the conviction that something had happened. His mind, as well as his body, performed a complete circle each time without arriving at anything new. He noticed this, rubbed his forehead, and sat down in her room. Here, as he looked at her table, at the malachite cover of her blotting-book and an unfinished letter that lay there, his thoughts suddenly underwent a change. He began thinking about her, of what she thought and felt. For the first time he vividly pictured to himself her personal life, her thoughts, her wishes. But the idea that she might and should have her own independent life appeared to him so dreadful that he hastened to drive it away. That was the abyss into which he feared to look. To put himself in thought and feeling into another being was a mental action foreign to Karenin. He considered such mental acts to be injurious and dangerous romancing. "And what is most terrible of all," thought he, "is that just now, when my work is coming to completion," he was thinking of the project he was then carrying through, "when I need peace and all my powers of mind, just now this stupid anxiety falls on me. But what is to be done? I am not one of those who suffer anxiety and agitation and have not the courage to look them in the face. I must think it over, come to a decision, and throw it off," he said aloud. "The question of her feelings, of what has taken place or may take place in her soul, is not my business. It is the business of her conscience and belongs to religion," said he,
feeling relieved at having found the formal category to which the newly arisen circumstances rightly belonged.
"Well, then," thought he, "the question of her feelings and so on are questions for her conscience which cannot concern me. My duty is clearly defined. As head of the family, I am the person whose duty is to guide her, and who is, therefore, partly responsible. I must show her the danger which I see, warn her, and even use my authority. I must speak plainly to her."
What he would say to his wife took clear shape in Karenin's head. Thinking it over, he regretted having to expend his time and powers of mind on inconspicuous domestic affairs, but nevertheless, clearly and definitely, as though it were an official report, the form and sequence of the speech he had to make shaped itself in his mind. "I must make the following quite clear. First, the importance of public opinion and propriety. Secondly, the religious meaning of marriage. Thirdly, if necessary, I must refer to the harm that may result to our son. Fourthly, allude to her own unhappiness." And, interlacing his fingers, palms downwards, he stretched them and the joints cracked. That movement, a bad habit of cracking his fingers, always tranquillized him and brought him back to that precision of mind which he now so needed. The sound of a carriage driving up to the front door was heard, and Karenin stood still in the middle of the room. A woman's steps were heard ascending the stairs. Karenin, ready to deliver his speech, stood pressing his interlaced fingers together, trying whether some of them would not crack again. One of the joints did crack. By the sound of her light step on the stair, he was aware of her approach, and, though he was satisfied with his speech, he felt some apprehension of the coming explanations.
Chapter 9. Anna walked in with bowed head, playing with the tassels of her hood. Her face shone with a vivid glow, but it was not a joyous glow. It resembled the terrible glow of a conflagration on a dark night. On seeing her husband, she lifted her head and, as if awakening from sleep, smiled. "Are you not in bed? What a wonder," she said, throwing off her hood, and without pausing she went on to her dressing room.
"Alexei Alexandrovich, it's high time," she added from beyond the door.
"Anna, I must have a talk with you."
"With me?"
she said with surprise, coming back from the other room and looking at him.
"What is it? What about?"
she asked, seating herself.
"Well, let us have a talk if it is so important, but it would be better to go to bed."
Anna said what came into her head, and, hearing her own words, was astonished at her capacity for deception. How simple and natural her words sounded, and how really it seemed as if she were merely sleepy. She felt herself clothed in an impenetrable armour of lies, and that some unseen power was helping and supporting her.
"Anna, I must warn you," said he.
"Warn me?"
she asked.
"What about?"
She looked so naturally and gaily at him that one who did not know her, as her husband did, could not have noticed anything strange in the intonation or the meaning of her words. But for him, who knew her, knew that when he went to bed 5 minutes late she noticed it and asked the reason, knew that she had always immediately told him all her joys, pleasures, and sorrows, for him, her reluctance to notice his state of mind or to say a word about herself meant much. He saw that the depths of her soul, till now always open, were closed to him. More than that, he knew from her tone that she was not ashamed of this, but seemed to be saying frankly, "Yes, it is closed, and so it should be and will be in future." He now felt like a man who, on coming home, finds his house locked against him. "But perhaps the key can still be found," thought Karenin.
"I wish to warn you," he said in low tones.
that you may, by indiscretion and carelessness, give the world occasion to talk about you. Your too animated conversation tonight with Count Vronsky, he pronounced the name firmly and with quiet deliberation, attracted attention. As he spoke, he looked at her laughing eyes, terrible to him now in their impenetrability, and felt the uselessness and idleness of his words. "You are always like that," she replied, as if not understanding him at all, and intentionally taking notice only of his last words. "One day you dislike my being dull, another day my being happy. I was not dull. Does that offend you?" Karenin started and bent his hands to crack his fingers. "Oh, please don't crack your fingers. I dislike it so," she said.
"Anna, is this you?" said he, softly, making an effort and refraining from moving his hands.
"But whatever is the matter?" she asked in a tone of comical surprise and sincerity. "What do you want of me?" Karenin paused and rubbed his forehead and eyes. He felt that instead of doing what he had meant to do and warning his wife that she was making a mistake in the eyes of the world, he was involuntarily getting excited about a matter which concerned her conscience and was struggling against some barrier of his imagination. "This is what I intended to say," he continued, coldly and calmly, "and I ask you to listen to me. As you know, I consider jealousy an insulting and degrading feeling and will never allow myself to be guided by it. But there are certain laws of propriety which one cannot disregard with impunity. I did not notice it this evening, but judging by the impression created, all present noticed that you behaved and acted not quite as was desirable." "Really, I don't understand at all," said Anna, shrugging her shoulders. "It is all the same to him," she said to herself, "but society noticed, and that disturbs him." "You are not well, Alexei Alexandrovich," she added, rose and was about to pass out of the room, but he moved forward as if wishing to stop her. His face looked plainer and gloomier than she had ever yet seen it. Anna stopped, and throwing back her head and bending it to one side, she began with her quick hands to take out her hairpins.
"Well, I'm listening. What next?"
said she, quietly and mockingly.
"I am even listening with interest, because I should like to understand what it is all about."
As she spoke, she wondered at her quietly natural tone and at her correct choice of words. "I have not the right to inquire into all the details of your feelings, and in general I consider it useless and even harmful to do so," began Karenin. "By digging into our souls, we often dig up what might better have remained there unnoticed. Your feelings concern your own conscience, but it is my duty to you, to myself, and to God, to point out to you your duties. Our lives are bound together not by men, but by God. This bond can only be broken by a crime, and that kind of crime brings its punishment."
"I don't understand anything."
"Oh, dear.
And as ill luck will have it, I am dreadfully sleepy," said she, while with deft fingers she felt for the remaining pins in her hair.
"Anna, for God's sake, don't talk like that," he said mildly. "Perhaps I am mistaken, but believe me that what I am saying I say equally for my own sake and for yours. I am your husband, and I love you." For an instant her head had drooped, and the mocking spark in her eyes had died away, but the word love aroused her again. "Love," she thought. "As if he can love." If he had never heard people talk of love, he would never have wanted that word. He does not know what love is.
"Alexei Alexandrovich, I really do not understand," she replied. "Explain what you consider—"
"Allow me to finish. I love you, but I am not talking of myself.
The chief persons concerned are our son and yourself. I repeat, perhaps my words may seem quite superfluous to you. Perhaps they result from a mistake of mine. In that case, I ask your pardon. But if you feel that there are any grounds, however slight, I beg you to reflect, and if your heart prompts you to tell me... Karenin did not notice that he was saying something quite different from what he had prepared. I have nothing to say. Besides, she added rapidly and hardly repressing a smile, it really is bedtime. Karenin sighed and, without saying anything more, went into the bedroom. When she went there, he was already in bed. His lips were sternly compressed and his eyes did not look at her. Anna got into her bed and every moment expected that he would address her. She was afraid of what he would say and yet wished to hear it. But he remained silent. She lay waiting and motionless for a long time and then forgot him. She was thinking of another. She saw him and felt her heart fill with excitement and guilty joy at the thought. Suddenly she heard an even, quiet, nasal sound like whistling. For a moment, the sound he emitted seemed to have startled Karenin and he stopped. But after he had breathed twice, the whistling recommenced with fresh and calm regularity.
It's late. It's late, she whispered to herself and smiled.
For a long time she lay still with wide-open eyes, the brightness of which it seemed to her she could herself see in the darkness. Chapter 10 From that time, a new life began for Karenin and his wife. Nothing particular happened. Anna went into society as before, frequently visiting the Princess Betsy, and she met Vronsky everywhere. Karenin noticed this, but could do nothing. She met all his efforts to bring about an explanation by presenting an impenetrable wall of merry perplexity. Externally, things seemed as before, but their intimate relations with one another were completely changed. Karenin, strong as he was in his official activities, felt himself powerless here. Like an ox, he waited submissively with bowed head for the poleaxe which he felt was raised above him. Each time he began to think about it, he felt that he must try again, that by kindness, tenderness, and persuasion there was still a hope of saving her and obliging her to bethink herself. Every day he prepared himself to have a talk with her. But each time he began to speak with her, he felt the same spirit of evil and falsehood which had taken possession of her master him also. And he neither said the things he meant to, nor spoke in the tone he had meant to adopt. He spoke involuntarily in his habitual half-bantering tone, which seemed to make fun of those who said such things seriously. And in that tone, it was impossible to say what had to be said to her. Chapter 11 That which for nearly a year had been Vronsky's sole and exclusive desire, supplanting all his former desires, that which for Anna had been an impossible, dreadful, but all the more bewitching dream of happiness, had come to pass. Pale, with trembling lower jaw, he stood over her, entreating her to be calm, himself not knowing why or how.
Anna, Anna, he said in trembling voice, Anna.